I cannot recall when I did not feel that what Jesus had to say about the governing of this planet was a vital thing for us in the 20th century's life. I believe that in this crisis that the world now experiences, our hope is in the teaching of the Bible. Our faith is indeed biblical, but only the sensitive person who has this biblical faith can contribute very much to the purging of our common life of those things that are unwholesome and corrupt. It was put pretty well by Ernest Hocking, who said, "It is only religion, reaching the ultimate solitude of the soul, that can create the unpurchasable man. And it is only man, unpurchasable by any society, that can create the sound society." I remember how deeply moved I was as a lad in Russellville when I sensed the full meaning of that cryptic little sentence in the New Testament. "The common people heard him gladly." I looked out at the green hills that surrounded that little town. But when I reached those hills on summer visits, I found that there was something beside loveliness. Here was poverty. Here was suffering. Here was a struggle because of adversity. And Christian civilization came to have this challenge that I think must have been in the mind of Dr. Whitehead when he said that this Christian civilization is an offensive against the repetitive mechanisms of the universe, for the floods that came and the tornadoes that visited them and all of the hazards of farming life were there to make an impact upon their physical existence. And they had not learned, these people on those hillsides, they had not learned how the resources of a mighty nation could be used to help them in their struggle for a better material existence. And sometimes the things I heard in the courthouse speeches were not inspiring. I could respond as there was furious reaction in the speech to these adversities, but I knew the remedies that were advanced were not sound. And I only wanted to make real in the life of my state and of the South the teachings of the founder of my faith. The first time that I ever saw my name mentioned in a book, and one could not be in politics as long as I without eventually finding his name in a book, so it's not immodest for me to refer to it. Actually, it was not a very favorable reference. It was in criticism of something legislatively, but it had a beautiful little capstone. The author said, "Nevertheless, Mr. Hayes has never ceased to love the rural South which nurtured him." In the first visit that I paid New Orleans some 30 years ago, I spoke to the Association of Commerce on their obligation to these people of whom I speak. So I have not come tonight to speak of urban problems primarily. I'm speaking of tensions, but some tensions have been relieved, and to some extent there was good news out of the struggles of that period in the 30s when we had the Depression and when cities began to realize, perhaps as never before, their dependence upon rural life. And rural people had a little less provincialism as they looked to Washington for substantial help and realized that in the cities, in the centers of our nation, were powerful forces latent that could be used to lift their lives. This is not a new experience necessarily, though no civilization has ever had the glamour that we have had, nor the involved economic life. But no city can afford to forget those who live outside its limits. When Paul visited Antioch, he found a city half the size of New Orleans. But today there are scarcely 3,000 people there. And the city was lost. It was buried beneath the silt that flowed down from the highland of Asia Minor, because the affluent people of Antioch were no longer interested in the poverty of the tableland. I dwell upon this economic base for the good society only to point out that there are human elements in it. City people must love these country people if they really help them, and the other is just as true. And it's interesting to me how many who assemble in the religious services of a mighty city came from the little churches and the little towns to which I affectionately allude tonight. Now, we have passed from that era of difficulty, and who can doubt that we had, the younger people do not recall the Depression, and I would not burden them with these grim pictures for, it's just a matter of a little background of my own thinking as I contemplated this marvelous experience tonight. I was speaking over in Dalton, Georgia not long ago and told something about these struggles. The old-timers can remember it. Before the great collapse of 1930, 1929, we had had these problems of which I spoke. My evolving philosophy, you see, was built upon it. I said that the farmer had spoken rather perceptively to me in the Depression when he said, Brooks, the Depression wouldn't have been near so bad if it hadn't come along right in the middle of hard times. And the chairman said, Mr. Hayes is right about it. Said, I said to a fellow once, do you remember 1933? He said, sure. Said, that's the year I broke my arm. Said, broke the arm? He said, yeah, I was eating my breakfast and I fell out of the persimmon tree. Jesus wanted to minister to these people, and we, his disciples, must seek to minister to them. We have passed from that difficult period to a period in which there is some affluence, of course, even in the countryside, though to be sure the restlessness of the American people creates new problems for you. 500,000 young people move out of the little towns like Russellville into the city. And I can see evidence that under George Wilson's skillful handling as your executive and defined leadership you have in New Orleans, that you're trying not only to provide the outlets for them, finding jobs for them, but you're going to attend to their moral and spiritual needs. This is one of the great challenges of modern time. And these 500,000 young people may not be aware of it, but one source of hope for them is the strength that is in the churches of the cities. So I salute you for the united effort that you are making. Now let me speak of unity. We need, I think, a greater spirit of unity in our religious community, in our nation. To be sure, the adversaries today can best be described in terms of atheism and materialism, the negation of the things in which we believe. I feel a great congeniality with my Baptist friends, of course, but I also feel a great congeniality with my fellow Protestants. This is not to speak disparagement of the need of a great rapport, a new spirit of unity with our Catholic friends, for me to say I know why I am a Protestant. I know that the Protestant contribution to the science of government is profound, and I think we of the Protestant faith in the world today have convinced Catholics who might have thought otherwise one time that we do not seek ever to destroy the Catholic Church. We would not deny we have sought to influence it, Catholic thought, as they have in the past influenced us. Cardinal Kernig said, surely Catholics can see that in nations like the United States, where there is separation of church and state, there is greater spiritual strength and moral power than in nations where we rely upon a political prop. Perhaps he was thinking of Spain. At any rate, this would be an objective judgment. I know, in short, as a student of government, why I am a Protestant and why I take pride in the contribution that the Protestant Reformation made to democracy, the science of government, to the spirit of freedom in our world. And still, I love my Catholic friends. On this occasion, I think I'd like to refer to the significance of a visit I had with Pope John, because this is something that has significance in the context of the struggle in our homeland. When I went into his presence on October 23rd, 1961, he said, "Mr. Hayes, I know you're a Baptist, and Baptists and Catholics perhaps have not always been as cordial as they should be, but after all, you know, I too am Baptist. I'm John the Baptist 23rd. The high point of that meeting was when he said, "We are brothers in Christ." This is historic. And I asked permission of the beloved Monsignor Parish priest in Granger, Iowa, who was my interpreter. I asked if I might quote him, because it was a historic utterance, and I had his permission. And now let me speak of the other tension, and that has to do with the race problem. This is the great task that confronts the Christians of our land. I'm not sure but that this struggle in the realm of racial justice and racial harmony is the severest test of our democratic ideals that our nation has ever had, and we must meet that test. I believe we are. On the occasion of my visit to New Orleans 30 years ago, almost, I had just been in a meeting at Birmingham. I remember as I walked into the meeting there, it was dedicated to improving conditions in the Southland. I was in the presence of Mark Etheridge of Macon, Georgia, and Charles Johnson, president of Fisk University, a Negro. And the policeman at the door said, "You white men sit here, the Negroes sit over here." And my friend Mark Etheridge said, "But we're talking about something. We're together. We three don't want to be separated." He said, "You do as I say or you'll wind up in jail." So Mark Etheridge and I sat there, suffering perhaps more than Charles Johnson, with dignity and with no complaint. He took his seat on the side reserved for the colored people. Mark said, "You see, what hurts me is that this is not only an affront to our friend, but it is an insult to us, for he has deprived me of my rights. I wanted to sit with our friend and was not permitted to do it." There have been occasions, and they have not been too far removed in terms of time, when the kind of meeting we have had tonight, where the two races can sit together and eat together, where this would not have been possible even in the cosmopolitan city of New Orleans. So we make great strides forward. One of the overlooked titles in the Civil Rights Act is Title 10, that has to do with conciliation. Now, I believe in the force of law. I'm not interested in some of the esoteric and involved and theoretical arguments about legislating morals. I think sometimes you can legislate morals. I agree with the old adage, as a young lawyer I learned this one, that social opinion must be in advance of law. I know that's true. And the greater or less happiness of the people, the teacher added, depends upon the narrowness of the gulf between them. But social opinion was in advance of the civil rights law, not in New Orleans or in Little Rock or in the South, but in the nation. And this was a product of national thought. The nation's conscience, of which we are a part, had been prodded, had been stirred. Well, we realized that injustices were being suffered by a Negro people that the Christian nation should not tolerate any longer. I heard pretty early in my congressional career encomiums of Southern statesmanship. And to be sure, I think they're earned. I think my colleagues from the South exhibited great skill. You have some great men from Louisiana. Senator Long asked me to bear his greetings to you. Outstanding. My longtime friend Hale Boggs, whose message I'm deeply grateful for, sent his greetings, of course. And Congressman A. Bear, in whose district we are meeting now, talked to me on the phone yesterday and asked me to convey his greeting. Louisiana has contributed mightily to Southern statesmanship, as the South has. But we were wrong in the South if we assumed that these compliments meant that the nation approved our patterns of race conduct, or that they intended for us to perpetuate those customs merely because we preferred them. But this should not embarrass us. We are a part of the nation. And sometimes proximity itself is a handicap in building Christian standards in the community. That's the reason changes of venue were granted in court. people are often too close to a problem to get the perspective they need as Christians to adjust them. And we needed, in this situation of race conflict, a national judgment, a national standard, a national policy. And we got it in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it's a good law. My heart is singing because the president signed it and because it is a bipartisan effort, represented a contribution from the Republicans as well as the Democrats. I believe in party loyalty and sometimes in responsible party action. That's a wholesome thing, the ferment of opinion, the conflict of ideas in national councils. But here was too important a matter. It had the spiritual aspect. I was proud of the fact that it represented a Republican as well as a Democratic triumph. But let us quickly realize that the courts spoke first, the Congress spoke next. And I believe it's fair to say that since the issue was joined by a constitutional argument from the Republican nominee, that the people spoke. And the fact that Louisiana happened to be in the minority on it does not alter the conclusion I'm reaching myself personally. The Christian conclusion, whatever one's preference is to party, and this has no touch of partisanship, I'm speaking of the national judgment that the South must alter its patterns, but I'm quite sure that the South is going to act responsibly and nobly. The noble side of the South will be expressed as it has already been expressed in New Orleans, and we will demonstrate to the nation that we want our Negro people to be at home among us, to feel that they are a participating part of our society, that they shall be given access to the ballot box, they shall be given fair treatment in employment. Then we will take Title 10, under whose auspices Governor Collins, who heads the community services activity in Washington, under whose auspices I was to go to your neighboring city to talk about the church contribution. For the churches do have a contribution in creating the spiritual climate in which progress can be made. For while law is essential, declarations that are firm in our jurisprudence must be accepted. Nevertheless, as Paul said, some things the law cannot do in that it is weak. There are these added things that only love and compassion and goodwill can produce. This is the unfinished part of the task. And Title 10 authorizes this kind of consultation. And I am happy to see our Negro friends, as they patiently accept injustices sometimes, determined as they are not to wound us, patiently accepting injustice, but always looking hopefully to their white friends within the power structure of the states and localities to lead the people, the masses of the people, sometimes so indifferent to the aspirations of the minority group. We must not be so irritated in the assault we suffer from both the right and the left, the extremists on each side. Actually, it is produced by the same phenomenon, I think, in human life. You know, there isn't a great deal of difference between a rightist who is extreme and a leftist who is extreme. They really do not move in this direction, getting miles apart. They move in a circle, and they come together. That's the reason Ulbricht in East Germany has at his side today, serving his government, a communist government, some of the most violent Nazis that Hitler had. It's the reason in Hitler's regime, in the Nazi camp, you found many former communists, because the spirit of extremism destroys some of these slogans and catchphrases, and we find extremism converging so that our enemy is extremism. Not that moderation is always the answer. Truth is sometimes highly partisan, and sometimes justice lays a heavy burden upon the backs of its reluctant disciples. We must recognize truth where we find it and be loyal to it, but our methods can be moderate, and we can lovingly approach these problems, hoping for a solution that grows out of nonviolence. These are the words of hope that I'd like to bring you. I close with one other little incident. I walked into the hotel lobby in the Andrew Johnson Hotel one day. It was in November, or December perhaps, of 1960, shortly after the election of Mr. Kennedy. I walked into the hotel lobby that morning after a little mission to one of the valley towns, and I was met at the door by a lad we called a bellboy, Leon. He was my friend. He worked at odd hours in the hotel while he went through college, Knoxville College, a church school, and we'd become congenial friends. He said, Mr. Hayes, maybe you haven't seen the paper this morning. You've been appointed Assistant Secretary of State. And he said, I'm glad. He said, you see, I do not agree with Plato that the mechanisms of democracy seldom raise the best men to the top. I said, did Plato say that? I didn't know it. I doubt that Aubrey Walton knew it. And as we went to the elevator, he said, and Mr. Hayes, I want to argue with you sometime about something you said in your book. It gave me an excuse to tell him I'd written more than one book, and excuses me for telling you I've written three. And I said, well, you see, he's a smart lad. He not only reads Plato, he reads Hayes. And he deposited the bags and left, and I sat in our little suite alone. There I had, I think, the profoundest meditation on the effect of this change of fortune, my retirement from Congress, the most profound thought that had ever engaged me, either before or since. And it was this. You see, I had been wounded in the Little Rock experience. My people had chosen to change their representation, and surely you won't misunderstand me. This was their privilege. No one believes more devotedly than I in government by consent of the governed. People often change their officers, and that's a part of this glorious profession of government. I could not rebel, but I'd be less than honest if I did not say that I was deeply hurt inside because of the nature of that conflict. I was wounded because at the height of my usefulness to them, they had repudiated me. I was hurt, but I was not bitter. I point only to this, that a door of opportunity had been closed, the opportunity for further service to a people I love. And this was the cause of my wound. But then I thought of Leon, and of the doors of opportunity that may be closed to him. If they are, if a door of opportunity is closed to him, this competent, dedicated, ambitious lad, it will be because of his race. And in the light of that contrast, my own misfortune and disappointment, and that tragedy that could befall a race in the absence of imagination and compassion on the part of the people of my land, my own experience appeared menacing. For if 10 years from now he must still carry bags in a hotel to make a living, the American dream will not have been fulfilled. Dear church people of New Orleans, you of the Protestant community with distinctive beliefs, and even as Protestants we are not united in belief and doctrine. We are united only in spirit, and this spirit we would want to pervade the great city which lies in this strategic part of the greatest, perhaps, of all the nations. Let us resolve that we will be faithful in carrying out this mandate of a good society based upon love and sacrifice, and that our model will be New Testament revelation which exalts these elements in life. And let us not tire of the task. God has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat. He is sifting out the souls of men before his judgment seat. Be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on.